Tarek, you're just firing off a tweet.
Yeah.
What's it saying?
Oh, it's pretty much saying there's no news about the Manchester City case, or no new news. Richard Masters, the Premier League chief executive, was asked about the case, and he said it's going to happen in the near future. Has that suddenly got the alarm bells going, Rob? Any news? It's the exact same period it was going to be, wasn't it?
That's the teaser. Welcome to Sport Unlocked, joining me, Rob Harris from Sky News Ever, Tarek Pandya from the New York Times, Martin Ziegler from the Times, and we have had the chance to talk to Richard Masters about the Manchester City case.
Yeah, and we got no new information.
What did he say?
Well, he said that the case is going to be concluded in the near future. That's got everyone very excited, hot under the collar. But Martin, what did he tell Parliament earlier this year or late last year? It was going to be this year, wasn't it?
No, he didn't say that. He just
said
it will, that he can't, that a date has been set. So anyway, I think it was sort of reported, I think last year, that it's going to be probably going to be at the end of October, and the outcome next year. And I think from what I have gathered, I think nothing's changed. It's probably still going to be then. So maybe the near future. He says it will be resolved in the near future. So maybe a year is the near future.
The reason we're talking about this, because on Friday at the European Leagues press conference, Richard Masters was leading the show. They were meeting in London, and it was quite a rare appearance for Richard Masters in front of the media. And that's why he was asked about the Manchester City case, where things were going. Also, what else came up in the discussion? He was critical of FIFA, wasn't he?
Very critical of FIFA. Pretty much saying there is absolutely no dialogue between the leagues and FIFA. FIFA essentially doing whatever it wants. And the other horrible word to use, alert, stakeholders only finding out when these decisions are taken. And he compared that unfavorably to the relationship with UEFA, saying they've got a memorandum of understanding with them where terms are pretty explicit over how things should work.
Yeah, particularly on how FIFA are acting. They said that they're overloading the calendar and overloading the players. That's with reference to more international games, the expanded Club World Cup, expanded World Cup. And Richard Masters said there is too much football being played.
Yeah, well, he said, Martin, he said the cup was already full and now it's pretty much overflowing, i.e. there's just the calendar cannot take the new football. And he said the Premier League itself hasn't changed any of its demands on clubs. These are new international and regional competitions. Again, potentially a dig here at FIFA.
And UEFA, perhaps. They're expanding the Champions League, aren't they?
UEFA did come and address these meetings.
Oh, do they? Okay, so maybe they've resolved it with UEFA, but yes. I mean, I think you did something, Rob, fairly recently about the sort of the calendar, you know, the overloading of the matches. And was it after somebody said that if somebody like Manchester City, potentially, who are in the Club World Cup next year, they could play something crazy, like in 2 years, play something like 176 competitive games?
Yeah, with all the competitions that they're in contention for, they won't be in the new FIFA Intercontinental Cup that's taking place in December in the place of the old Club World Cup between the European and South American champions, because they can't win the Champions League. But there's enough other games in the calendar. And the one competition that has reduced in size is the Premier League, because it started off with 22 clubs in 1992 and went down to 20.
Well, funny enough, Rob, Manchester City has been the club in recent times that has complained the most, about the overloaded schedule. You had Rodri, who said he needed a rest, and then you had Pep Guardiola. After qualifying for the FA Cup final, after beating Chelsea in the semi-final, using the interviews afterwards pretty much to slam the fixture schedule and the congestion, probably the cost of playing so well, isn't it? You know, with that squad they've got, they seem to be beating all comers.
This is an interesting attack, I would say, on FIFA from Richard Masters, the Premier League chief executive, coming a week after a very curious late night Instagram post from Gianni Infantino's account that they were pushing from FIFA. He said, "It was announced last week that the English Premier League club spent almost €500 million on fees to intermediaries and agents." This was from 2023 to 2024. Infantino wrote, "Most of this money is leaving football. In the same period, English clubs played less than 30 million euros to the clubs that trained and developed the players signed from abroad. And then he went on to say the compensation and solidarity payments are imposed by FIFA regulations and are vital for thousands of less privileged clubs who struggle to generate sufficient revenue and are therefore crucial for developing, training and giving opportunity to young players around the world. And he went on to basically appeal for action from countries, governments, lawmakers to join them to keep the funds in football.
And the other thing about the agents' legal challenges which FIFA brought, I mean, if you speak to lawyers in this sort of sports law experts, they say that actually FIFA never had a chance of winning it at all. And so this was almost like sort of window dressing to try and sort of show that they were basically trying to, you know, talk tough, but realizing that it was never going to get through.
Yeah, interesting. Gianni Infantino there conducting strategy with a late night Friday night Instagram post. He did call on governments to help them. This then coming days before a warning from both FIFA and UEFA about interference in Spain.
Yeah, so it's a really, really good point. It's where FIFA tend to get upset when external forces, if you want, get involved with football. And this case in Spain is related to the fact the FA doesn't have a president. They lost Luis Rubiales. We don't need to waste too much time now discussing why he's not there. Much discussed. But then the issue is the guy who was supposed to replace him, guy, I think it's called Pedro Rocha, he's facing a raft of charges and allegations himself, and now the Spanish government essentially has taken oversight of the Spanish FA. And it's not just any FA, is it? It's the Women's World Cup champions are from Spain, recent World Cup champions also from Spain. It's a big FA. And FIFA have pretty much, with UEFA, put out a statement saying they've got them on alert. They don't seem to like it, do they, Rob?
No, it's the intervention that perhaps might have benefited Spanish football some time before, given the fact there were the concerns about how things were being conducted, led to various investigations, obviously, about taking games to Saudi Arabia and the process behind that, rather than it being Saudi Arabia per se. And of course, the slowness to call out Rubiales. I mean, it did strike me that there was more strident tone on this in the Spanish FA than there was perhaps towards Rubiales himself in the case last year.
Yeah, the 2030 World Cup hosts, of course. So that's something else to bear in mind. Do you guys think about talking about government interference in football? So Tim Farron, the Liberal Democrat leader, has said that he was going to put an amendment into the football governance bill, saying that the new independent football regulator will have to ensure that FA Cup replays are kept in English football. Do you think that is government interference in football? Would FIFA not accept that? Think that's a step too far?
This all relating to English football and English politics, Liberal Democrats. This doesn't seem to me cover the government interference policies. I mean, that seems to be to me about more governments imposing who will be the chief exec of the FA, who will be the chair, who will be the manager even in the national teams, that sort of interference rather than sort of broader policies.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question as well as to the role of this regulator. It seems to have evolved every few weeks. Wasn't it supposed to be a financial issues that it was going to be limited to? Now, every week until this thing happens, Martin, you have now FA Cup replays being chucked in. You know, are they going to be picking the teams next? Are they going to say, sorry, you know, I want this striker at my club, said MP from whichever place? Martin, you had something you wanted to say.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things about the parliamentary process, and that people can make amendments. Anyone, any MP can put an amendment in. So that's why I suppose you've had the Premier League been sort of jumping up and down a bit recently, because that's what they fear the most. It's not so much what the bill says now, it's what it will say when it goes to become law.
In 1999, when Glenn Hoddle's Future of England manager was under the spotlight, it was the then Prime Minister, Tony Blair, who helped usher him out the door, really. Didn't he say he had to go this over when he made those comments that were offensive about disabled people?
Yeah, but he didn't have he might have made a comment. I don't think he, you know, knocked on the door and said he has to be removed by the fiat of the British government. I think he was just making a comment. I think other
should he go was the question at the time, and Blair responded, "It's difficult to stay in those circumstances." Yes, but yeah, it wasn't an order. He wasn't turning up at FA headquarters.
But there was a case recently, actually. I think it was whether it was Cameroon or one of the countries in West Africa recently, where the FA was surprised that the sports ministry has just appointed a new coach. I think it was Cameroon. It was the appointment of the man to replace Rigobert Song. Took the Cameroon FA by surprise.
Yeah, well, maybe governments would get involved in whether domestic league games should be played abroad. This has been going through the US case, and of course the Premier League did try to usher in Game 39 15 years or so ago. It was met with widespread opposition. That was the adding of a game that would be played all around the world, and adding of a round. Javier Tebas has been trying to play La Liga games in the US, something that sort of crumbled a few years ago amid opposition, but he's been back on that agenda.
Yeah, so that's really interesting in the kind of timeline of things. As soon as this case that involved Relevant, the American sports marketing company, and FIFA and CONCACAF, the regional body in America, was kind of put on hold, Javier Tebas, who tried to play a Barcelona v Girona game in Miami in 2018, is suddenly fired up again, saying it's his intention to play a La Liga game in 2025. Any surprises, Martin?
No, not at all. Richard Masters said that there was no plans for the Premier League to follow suit. Don't think they'll be able to, but of course, I'm sure that's going to be the first thing. And I think, as you suggested when we mentioned this before, how long till Saudi Arabia does the same?
You missed out there saying Richard Masters gives major update on Premier League matches abroad. News to come.
Yeah.
But actually on that and how Javier Tebas is, I mean, he was previously backing a rival body, wasn't he, to the European Club Association, the Union of European Clubs. But then he turned up at the European Club Association meeting in Madrid this week, didn't he?
He turned up at the ECA meeting in Madrid, and by all accounts was a different man, quite conciliatory to the spewing vitriol as he normally does at these places. However, I think, yes, you're right, he provided seed funding for the UEC, a body for the small, medium-sized clubs who've been excluded over the years. But I tell you, one place he didn't turn up at was the European Leagues meeting here in London. I don't know how many dozens of leagues there were here. Spain, famously under Tebas, has walked out, saying it's kind of impotent, has no power. So he's doing his own thing.
You missed out on the goodie bag that we spotted them getting. Yeah. Did we discover what was in it?
No, it's a mystery.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Email in if you've received one of those goodie bags.
He was the European League's representative on UEFA, wasn't he?
Yep, he was. He got a board seat on the UEFA Exco and, walked out in a huff and had to leave that role as well.
So nothing in the goodie bags from any of the sponsors, maybe the Premier League, but FIFA this week have signed up a new sponsor. Do you think that they're going to be handing out some of the product to, I don't know, players, managers, fans around the world? What do you think Amoroco can hand out?
Martin, I should let you hold the floor here. You mentioned Saudi Aramco some months ago, and that's finally been consummated. What are we looking at here, Ziggs?
Does it often take so long for a story to be confirmed?
Yes. So oil and gas, they can provide goodie bags with a little bottle of oil if you want. But this Aramco are the richest company, oil and gas company in the world. They have had a fall of profits last year, so it's, I'm afraid they only made
how are they struggling?
Yeah, they only made something like $131 billion instead of $165 billion.
Harry, was it you pointed out about fan engagement? Didn't they offer new forms of engagement? How does an oil and gas company engage with fans apart from discounts on petrol for the cars, perhaps?
It's a real mystery as to what this press release gobbledygook was announcing this thing. And you wonder who the consultants who are hired, probably well remunerated, to put these things out. But they said through this relationship, Aramco will find new and innovative ways to present football to the world, to the masses. Now, I just want to know what expertise the oil and gas giants have to do this.
Well, they've got a lot of cash, so who knows? Maybe they're funding football projects around the world. They're not said no indoor pitches or things like that. But obviously, we're left guessing because there's no press conference. There's no detail in
it. There isn't, but it wasn't. It was more the word, the expertise they have. I mean, cash isn't expertise.
Aramco do own a football club. They share senior executives with the Public Investment Fund who own Newcastle United.
Which football club do they own?
They own Al Qadsiyah in the Saudi Pro League.
Since the summer of 2023, which I hope would have undergone a lot of change thanks to the innovations and expertise that only Saudi Aramco can bring to the field of football.
Is that Wikipedia? Are you reading off?
No.
Yeah, you're reading off a press release.
I was up from there.
The only thing you could say about that is that means that Aramco and Saudi PIF are going head to head, aren't they? Because PIF have got four clubs, whereas Saudi's only got Aramco's only got one.
No, but Martin, seriously, in terms of FIFA, this is going to be one of their biggest, if not biggest, sponsorship deals, right? And it's been very reliant on this type of money coming in, isn't it? They've got all these projects. We might even see more Saudi sponsors, won't we?
Yeah, we did have Visit Saudi, who were dropped as a Women's World Cup sponsor after the backlash. So you wonder if this is somehow interconnected, that they have got their Saudi sponsorship after all. And obviously, it was quite a charge, you know, led by Australia, wasn't there, against that Visit Saudi sponsorship? You know, we had a lot of people coming on to us who were sort of lobbying on that behalf.
Mm-hmm. What's all the money going to be used for, anyway? People might want to know, what is the money going to be used for?
Well, they've actually said it's to continue FIFA's development work. And they pointed out in that press release about the $8 million that each national federation gets from the Forward program. But I also think it's going to be used to fluff up some of the cash pot for the Club World Cup in 2025 next year. We spoke about that in the last pod, and they really need to build that up in order to get teams to take the competition seriously.
Yeah, the challenge there to raise the revenue to provide the huge payments that might entice clubs to be there. But Saudi Arabia, something we regularly discuss, perhaps a smaller league is not something very much on our agenda, but it struck my eye. How does a league cope when it's surrounded by far bigger competitions on all sides? And from England, Wales doesn't just have the Premier League, but the EFL as a huge rival competition. And the fact that some of its biggest clubs, of course, do play in the EFL. Wrexham, the Hollywood ownership, Cardiff and Swansea. So they have actually just, some might say, given into that and formed their own path, but announcing they're going to play their games this on Friday nights. And again, this is perhaps a success of FIFA. They will have VAR, but the new VAR Lite, which is the system that can operate in smaller countries with fewer cameras. Although there are many around the world who'd be delighted not to have VAR, with some developments on that this week too.
Yeah, Sweden. Fredrik Reinfeldt, who is the former Swedish Prime Minister, now Swedish FA President, about a year ago was saying VAR is a future, and now he's basically been forced into saying that they're not going to bring it into Swedish football. And interestingly, I think this is particularly interestingly, that UEFA is not going to require them to do so.
So they've reviewed their decision.
They have reviewed their decision indeed. I think some 18 of the 32 clubs in Sweden's top clubs voted against it. They have the 51% fan ownership requirement in Sweden, which probably reflects that. So, I think it's the only one of the top 30 countries in the world not to introduce VAR.
Well, it's interesting. We had last Christer Olsen here in London. He was attending the summit here. He was head of the Swedish league for a number of years. And he pointed out that most of the Swedish teams are member-owned and the members don't like VAR. So whatever this president guy wanted or wouldn't have liked, you can't have your own way as a powerful president in Sweden. The clubs and their members decide. And, you know, if readers, listeners are interested in more of this, my colleague on the New York Times, Rory Smith, done a really interesting article a few months ago of how Sweden have kind of tapped into this frustration when it comes to the modernity in football, the kind of creeping away from the traditional ways of enjoying watching football, communities, fans, and having no VAR is a part of that. So that's a really interesting article. If people are interested, they can look out for that.
As we're talking about interesting articles, of course, the pod we did in midweek due to the timings focused heavily on the WADA swimming case involving China and the fallout from that. Now, remind us just briefly, in case people weren't tuned, what was that story?
Yeah, it was a remarkable story back in 2021. 23 Chinese swimmers, elite swimmers, testing positive for banned drugs, trimetazidine, and essentially not being censured in any way for that. No public identification even, no temporary suspensions, not even a hearing. Some of them went on to win medals, including gold at the Olympics. And we and ARD, the German broadcaster, published details of that last week.
So what we've seen in recent days is WADA trying to defend its position, trying to insist it conducted the case with complete probity, that the fact it wasn't a need for strict liability, and the fact it accepted the reason of the Chinese swimmers and how their sample was contaminated.
Yeah, but they were essentially saying that they were contaminated because they found traces of this drug in a kitchen that prepared food for them 2.5 months before it was found. So quite an incredible story.
But the most notable development now from WADA, having tried to close the door on it, is they've announced this independent investigation. How independent will it be? Who is the person leading it?
It is a former attorney general from the Swiss canton of Vaud called Eric Cottier, monsieur. And what's quite interesting is Vaud is a place where a lot of these sports bodies are based. It's interesting how he has been chosen. We don't know why, but it is like the epicenter of sports governance. All the various governing bodies are there. And also VOD, it turns out, between 2005 and 2022, had paid subsidies of $135,000 to WADA to host its symposium. Again, just the fact he was the Attorney General of the period, it just is a curious thing that they've ended up there. This is an organized place they know, and it's a place that has provided some funds to them.
But the issue is, if you want someone truly independent in the complete sense, that has no connection to sport, and of course we're not suggesting he has a connection to sport, then they don't have the knowledge, do they? Doping cases are complicated. You know, if you had some sort of investigator...
Yeah, but he doesn't have the knowledge, Rob. He just happens to be from the area. This guy hasn't got any sporting knowledge, from what I can see.
Maybe that's even better then. You've just
argued against the point you were making.
I was arguing it two ways.
I did think when I saw the press release about this guy that they've appointed, that it was a bit of a strange choice. And you know, why pick him out? I mean, somebody might have thought he's a good person for various reasons. It might be legitimate reasons, but I mean, we don't know why. I think it would have been much better to have a sort of a process where there was some selection of somebody who was able to do it, which that they weren't appointing. That maybe that, you know, why didn't they speak to their big critics, USADA, first and agree somebody to do it, for example? It's just they're making a rod for their own back again and again.
Yeah, it's an optics thing as much as anything at this stage. And to give WADA their right to reply a bit, they did say that as far as they're concerned, they didn't do anything wrong. They would banker the president, Witold Banker, said they would do exactly the same thing again.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, the biggest issue now is that it's the swimmers that have been speaking out about this and that feel very uncomfortable about with what's happened. And I think that's the biggest problem for WADA, actually. It's not so much USADA, Travis Tygart being critical of them. It's the fact that it's the actual athletes who are very sort of concerned about what's happened. And I think that's their big thing that they need to deal with.
Yeah, it's going to take 2 months until we get a final version of this document. And you know already that battle lines are drawn. Travis Tygart, the USADA president, has already called it an effort to whitewash WADA's rep, even before the guy's actually done a day's work and produced a report. So so the battle lines are drawn. But it's a kind of an ugly episode just before Paris, and it's not going to go away because, as you mentioned, the swimmers are up in arms. They want clarity. Your colleague in the Times, Matt Lawton's, talked about potential legal action by swimmers who may feel that they've lost earnings as a result of this. It's that with Paris on the horizon, it's going to be a difficult and bumpy few months.
And finally, Tarek, a different venue for you this week, a court case involving agents in Chelsea.
Yep, Southwark Crown Court was the venue. This was a case involving the former Chelsea director, Marina Granovskaya, and a football agent called Saif Ruby. But in court, he was referred to as Saif Al Ruby. And it's related to an email that was sent to Marina Granovskaya by Ruby. Martin, you've written about this before. Do you want to tell us something about the content of the email that was produced in court?
Yeah, so this is an email, an angry email he sent about a £300,000 payment that he was owed, or he says he was owed. It led to him being charged with sending a malicious communication because of some of the language in it. We're still waiting the outcome, as we're recording, waiting the outcome of the trial. But there's been some interesting developments this week, which the prosecutor spelled out to the court that another agent, Keir Jarabchan, does a lot of business with English and other international clubs. He was a witness for the prosecution, and I'll just read what the prosecutor said. Keir Jarabchan was required to be at court on Tuesday, the 23rd of April, to give evidence. On the Monday, the prosecution contacted him to confirm his attendance. He initially told the officer he may not be able to attend court as he was due to fly abroad. And then he said he was feeling unwell and could not come to court to give evidence, but could do so over a video link. He was asked to get a doctor's note to confirm his diagnosis. The police made further repeated calls, and when the officer did manage to make contact with him, Mr. Jarabchan informed the officer that on Monday night he had got on a private jet and flown to the United States. So, Tarek, you attended this court case. Yeah. It's interesting.
It's definitely interesting, and there's a key piece of evidence because Mr. Jarabchan, he was referenced in the email that was read out in court. It was essentially Mr. Ruby demanding this money, explaining to Ms. Granovskaya that she wouldn't want what happened to Mr. Jarabchan happening to her if she didn't pay. And that is the subject of the case, really.
Yeah, the case being that Mr. Al Ruby allegedly demanded a payment from Marina Granovskaya and suggested there might be some harm, but he denies sending any communication with intent to cause distress, and the case continues.
Yeah, well, Rob, he told the court he was made to feel like Pablo Escobar. So, he's given his side. Now it's down to the jury.
That about brings an end to this week's episode of Sport Unlocked. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.